Good morning, everyone. I'll be doing the hearing. Today we're dealing with the hearing from Saxe A, which is the Arrowtown Design Guidelines.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Commissioners. In front of you on Friday, we filed some brief legal submissions and we also filed an evidence summary for both Mr. Bryce and Mr. Moss. This morning, I have handed up a copy of the Arrowtown Design Guidelines. And what that copy does is incorporate the changes that were filed by way of memorandum on the 27th of October. So the changes are only on pages 68, 69 and 70, but we just wanted to have that set for one complete session from you. Today the yellow strips across the pages, but that's being replaced. Turning to my written legal submission, what they do is address seven specific matters. There's a brief explanation on variation one. I'll speak briefly to you about the relevance of submitting the changes that have been made in the residential hearing, the relevance of submissions on the 2006 guidelines. I briefly addressed some submissions that were made on variation one that relates to the appropriateness of the median density residential zone within Arrowtown. The consequence of panel recommendations on zones that 2016 guidelines apply in, and very briefly, I addressed the evidence file on behalf of the New Zealand Fire Service on variation one. So starting at section three, variation one consists of the 2016 guidelines document, the incorporation of those guidelines into the proposed district plan, and specific changes to five chapters of the proposed district plan to update the reference from the 2006 guidelines to the 2016 guidelines. And I just mentioned there then also to delete the words and any adopted updates from notified policy 4252. So the relevant chapters that were amended by variation one are the urban development chapter four, and then the low density and medium density residential zones, Arrowtown residential historic management zone in chapter 10, and finally the Arrowtown town center chapter. The 2016 guidelines are largely based on the 2006 guidelines, but have been revised and updated to reflect changes that have occurred in Arrowtown since 2006, and also to provide guidance for future development in Arrowtown based on the zones that have been notified in stage one of the proposed district plan. And they have a purpose of ensuring that development is advanced in a manner that will protect and enhance the historic characteristics of Arrowtown. And this includes the retention of the early subdivision pattern and streetscape, and to ensure future development is at a scale and design that is sympathetic to the present character. And Mr. Bryce, in his summary to you this morning, will speak in more detail about the purpose of the guidelines. So in section four, I briefly set out for you here the relevance of some recommendations that have been made in residential hearing stream related to the medium and low density residential chapters. So you'll hear from Mr. Bryce that the design response for future development within the medium density residential zone is of particular importance, and this is because that zone borders the Arrowtown residential historic management zone along Suffolk and Kent Streets. Mr. Bryce's evidence is that if development intensification provided for after the proposed medium density zone is not appropriately designed to respond to the sensitivity of the adjoining historic management zone, there is the potential for the historic character and high amenity values of the historic management zone to be eroded over time. So in the hearing stream six, the residential chapters, Ms. Lee recommended, or has recommended, a new Arrowtown Historic Management Transition Overlay Area, which is to be applied over those properties along Suffolk Street and Kent Street. Ms. Leith has also recommended new restricted discretionary activity consent be required for the construction of any residential unit within that transition overlay area. And the purpose of this is to respond to the more sensitive interface between those two zones, which can be distinguished from the remainder of the medium density residential zone, where a restricted discretionary consent is triggered by the construction of two or more dwellings, and that is where the guidelines would be relevant as a matter of discretion. What that is meant for this hearing is that some amendments have been recommended to the guidelines, that they provide specific guidance for development undertaken within that transition overlay area. Turning to the low density residential zone, that also borders, albeit in a small area, the historic management zone. And in her section 42A for the low density chapter, Ms. Leith has recommended that the construction of any residential units in the next site area of between 300 and 449 square metres is a restricted discretionary activity. So in that situation, the guidelines would be considered as a matter of discretion. But development of no greater than one residential unit per 450 square metres is a permitted activity. And in that situation, the guidelines would not be triggered. Mr. Knott and Mr. Bryce have considered that in the evidence and response to submissions, and they've concluded that it's not necessary to have a transition overlay within the low density residential zone, as the potential for a development within the limited area to have a negative impact upon the setting of the Arrowtown residential historic management zone is low. So in paragraph 4.5, I summarise the consent requirements under a restricted discretionary activity consent, which I've just spoken through. So with your leave, sir, I'll just take that paragraph as read, but it summarises the situation as to when the guidelines would be a matter of discretion. Turning to paragraph 4.7, where a resource consent is required, consideration will be given to the extent to which the development responds positively to Arrowtown's character, utilising the 2016 guidelines as a guide. Application for resource consent under the proposed district plan in relevant areas in Arrowtown will therefore need to show how the 2016 guidelines have been considered and incorporated into the design. Turning to section 5, just very briefly, under clause 16B of schedule 1 of the RMA, every variation initiated under clause 16A shall be merged in and become part of the proposed plan as soon as the variation and the proposed plan are both at the same procedural stage, which is where we are now, which means the 2006 guidelines have been replaced. There was one submission of Mr. Mark Kramer, which was made on the Stage 1 notified 2006 guidelines. And under Clause 16B, any submissions made on the replaced provisions are deemed to be a submission on the variation. That submission wasn't considered in Mr. Bryce's Section 42A report, so he will address you on that this morning. And I understand Mr. Kramer is also a submitter on variation 1 as well. Turning to section 6, a number of submissions have been lodged against variation 1 that question the appropriateness of the medium density residential zone applying to Arrowtown. It's submitted that any submissions challenging the zone itself are not on variation 1, as what variation 1 does is replaces the 2006 guidelines with the 2016 version and incorporates them by reference into the proposed official plan. So it's the content of the guidelines which is the focus in the hearing today. The appropriate forum to consider these type of submissions was in the residential hearing stream 6, and there have been submissions made, and the 42A has considered those very types of submissions as to whether medium density development is appropriate in Harrison. And I've set out in footnote 17 the relevant part of this link, 42A report, which does address that matter, and I just note there that there are also rezoning submissions that are related to medium density zone in Arrowtown, and they will be considered in 2017 within the rezoning mapping hearing. In paragraph 6.4, although the 2016 guidelines do seek to respond to how development intensification within the proposed medium density zone can be suitably designed to ensure that interaction with the historic management zone is able to maintain enhance historic character and amenity values of the area. In summary, it is submitted that it is beyond the scope of Variation 1 to consider the merits or otherwise of the inclusion of the medium density residential zone in the proposed plan. Turning to Section 7, the consequence of the panel's decision on zones that the 2016 guidelines apply in. The purpose of these two paragraphs is just to foreshadow that the guidelines that are being recommended to you are based on the council's position as it's put forward in the residential hearing. And if through and after these hearings the panel makes any substantial changes to the residential chapters, there would possibly need to be some subsequent changes to the guidelines. And that includes down to the boundaries of the zones, because the guidelines do have, for example, neighbourhood areas in them. So if there are any subsequent changes to the chapters, we do need to consider how they flow through into the guidelines. And that is simply the purpose of Section 7 of the legal submission. Turning to Section 8, one statement of evidence has been filed by submitters, and that is Ms McLeod, the New Zealand Fire Service. Ms McLeod's evidence addresses that part of the Fire Service's submission for a change in activity status from restricted discretionary to non-compliant for any application for resource consent for the redevelopment of the Arrowtown Fire Station. This is a matter that Ms McLeod has addressed you on in the residential hearing, and it is submitted that is the appropriate forum for the panel's recommendation. Ms McLeod's evidence does go on to seek specific changes to the 2016 guidelines, and these are, of course, reflected within the scope of this hearing. The appropriate activity status of the rule that is addressed by Ms McLeod will be addressed by the council in its right of reply on the residential hearing. In terms of the changes to the guidelines, Mr Bryce will give evidence that these have merit, but with one suggested amendment, which I have copied into footnote 18, and Mr Bryce will also address you on later this morning. So the council will be calling evidence from Mr Richard Knott on heritage matters. Mr Knott provided technical input into the revision of the guidelines, and he will address you on the workability of the guidelines, the new transition overlay and subsequent changes needed to the guidelines, and also the approach taken in the low density residential zone. And then the council will call Mr Nigel Bryce, who is the author of the guidelines and also the 42A report.
Yes, thank you, sir. What I'm unclear of, having read the material, is how the guideline document sits inside the plan. My understanding is it's designed to be a standalone document.
They have been incorporated by reference at notification.
Yep.
So they, although they are a separate document, the effect of Schedule 1 does apply in that data.
So they're effectively a volume of the district plan, and
yes.
Should they document say that somewhere? That it's actually part of the district plan? It doesn't really say that at all, it just says the guidelines here to help.
No, they don't say that. Would have no objection to them saying in here that they
Well, I'm not proposing it. As I say, I'm here trying to make recommendations on it, and I'm still unclear, having read it all, where it sits. And if I've got that problem, maybe users might too.
Yes. Well, the public notice was very clear that it was incorporated by reference, and generally, it's documents that are incorporated by reference across the board, and it's just not in Queenstown, don't always say that they are incorporated into the respective district plan. But there could be some value in having, possibly in the introduction chapter, these documents are incorporated by reference into the plan or for something to that effect.
And the consequence, yeah, the consequence of that would be if the council wanted to make any change to the document in any way, it would need to go through a plan change process.
That would, yes.
Forgive the possible ignorance of this question. It's a function of my focus as a commissioner being on the residential parts of the plan. The guidelines talk extensively about what should happen on public reserve land, about what should happen within public roads. Are there any rules in the plan proposed for those areas that aren't possibly zoned residential that would require the outcomes of the guideline to be adhered to?
I don't know the answer to that question, but I will find out and come back to you after the break. Mr. Price might be able to answer it. Not immediately.
If we could, because as I understand the gestation of the document, it started from the 2006 document, which had its genesis outside of the plan, and it might be that it includes some material that may not actually be relevant to applicants on residential zoned land. And at this point in time, I'm not quite clear if I owned a piece of residential land in Arrowtown, what bits of the guideline I can actually say doesn't matter. But the principal difference by incorporating into the plan is that it becomes a 1041B matter rather than a 1041C consideration. Is that? Is there more to it than that?
Yes, and in addition to that, documents that are incorporated by reference have legal effect as if they were a rule, so they are essentially treated as if they were a rule in the plan. So that comes through Schedule 1 of the RNA. So when they're referenced, in this instance they're referenced in matters of discretion, but it is this version of the guidelines and they are the ones to be considered. Obviously you can then go to Section 1041C, that's a separate matter.
Does that mean that they have legal effect now? Given that provision in the Act that certain laws have legal effect to deal with, for example, heritage.
The rules that they are incorporated into, I don't believe have legal effect at this point in time.
Right.
So, no.
I was also interested in that last little discussion you had. From the point of view of my understanding of the rules in the plan, restrictions of discretion as policies, effectively, emphasising the guideline as a guide, but an awful lot of the guidance in the document are expressed as you must, development must, applicants must, which as a terminology, less of a guideline and more of a compulsion. Is there any, Mr. Bryce can tell us the rationale for the words chosen, but are there any, in your view, legal complications with having guidance that's expressed as firm requirements?
I'm I'm looking at the medium density residential matter of discretion, which is 8.4.11.
Hold on. So I'm looking at the section 42A, appendix 1, version.
Yes.
Okay.
So if we turn to the medium density residential zone, chapter 8.
Yep.
And we have their rule for 8.4.11. So discretion is restricted to all of the following, and then of relevance in arrow time. Consistency with Arrowtown's character, utilising the Arrowtown design guidelines 2015 as a guide. So what that's saying is that the council, when it's processing the consent, is considering the consistency of the proposal or the application before it with Arrowtown's character, and they have to use this document as a guide as they do that. So I don't believe it's enforcing, it's not requiring consistency with it, but that is the comparison or the information that they use to take a view on the matter.
I think it might be a bit more subtle than your answers suggested, to be frank, because if the guideline says you must be vanilla, and the council's discretion is to consistency with character using the guideline as a guide, and clearly you're not meeting the guideline if the guideline says you have to be vanilla and you're not, then doesn't that mean you're fundamentally struggling to be consistent with the character? Even if the guideline's a guide, if it says so strongly, you're in or you're out, as opposed to this is an important consideration and here's why it's important, etc., etc.
Yes, it could be, and I think that turns to what the wording and the guidelines are, and there are various commissions that have questioned the wording. I understand for those type of reasons, and Mr. Bryce has made a number of recommended changes to the guidelines. They are set out in the end of section 42A. It's a little bit difficult to show the changes that he's made, but I believe some of the submissions have. We think we need to make these changes because when we come in and make an application, that was a concern for us as to whether we would achieve that or not.
My last question is for you, and I think it might be one that I can go to Mr. Bryce and duplicate. Going through the documents, it states at 1.4, and I'm just using the simplicity of the version you must read the circular. Etc., and then there's the four colour codes. So if I'm a council planner and I've got an application before me and I'm turning my mind to the guideline, am I only looking at those sections of the guideline that correspond to those four colours in those little boxes, or am I obliged to consider the whole document? What are the actual guidelines within the guide is the question, I think.
I might pass that question to Mr. Bryce. I think
he'll
get an answer
if he's in the office. Okay, well, in that case, maybe we'll just wait until Mr. Bryce speaks. Because I think, it's that swirl in my mind of what is it that people are actually being asked to do. But one question I will persist with, following on from that, with you, are the checklists at the back. And so if we just turn to 5.6, which is on page 175, and we go to the very bottom item, a landscape architect has assessed the proposal at its effects. So if the answer to that is no, because I don't happen to like landscape architects, or I don't want to pay their exorbitant rates, or whatever, as a landowner, does that mean the council will section 92 me, or does that mean I'm falling out of the guidelines just because I think I can assess my own landscape effects because the guidelines have pages and pages of acceptable tree solutions in them?
Yes, so what the guidelines say is that there's a no review that particular aspect and seek ways to modify the proposal so that it can become a yes. There is only one way that can become a yes. And that's the landscape architect has assessed it.
isn't the problem there too that that might lead to the council getting its own landscape architectural assessment, imposing a charge on the applicant when that's only been done because the guideline, the checklist says it should be done, rather than it being the nature of the actual application requiring it?
It could do, and I will ask Mr. Bryce to speak to you about the purpose of that part, that checklist, that component.
It's interesting, it doesn't require a plan to assess it.
Or a conservation architect, a preparatory architect, for the purpose of the guidelines.
Yes.
No more questions from members.
I'm not sure you're appropriate is very much to ask at this time, but currently there's a panel, if I've got it right, that assesses applications to for building in the area and they refer to the guidelines. It doesn't necessarily go to council, is that correct?
I understand.
So what I'm saying is the guidelines are assessed by a local group rather than by the council.
Yes, it's a non-statutory process that sits outside the plan, so that isn't mentioned in the Auckland district plan, nor in the proposed district plan. Mr. Bryce does have more knowledge about that process than I do, but I do know that it's not referenced in the plan at present.
Is that process intended to continue?
Perhaps I can help. The reason I asked this is because I had a couple of instances while sitting on council, people who have been upset. One instance is an architect. Their design for the house was turned down by a panel, and they were going, who are this panel? What authority they've got on part of council? And I couldn't really answer them satisfactorily. This, what we're doing now, we're going to put a clarification around there.
I think, and to put it in context, we have had submissions in the residential stream that there should be more overview by the urban design panel, which is yet a separate body with a more formal arrangement with the council. And it's a bit obscure as to whether there's any intention that this other outside the plan arrangement is envisaged as a result, or will the consideration of the guidelines just be part of the normal consent process undertaken in the house.
The latter, sir, what Variation 1 does is formalise and incorporate these guidelines into the plan. Neither the notification of Stage 1 or Variation 1 addresses the non-statutory process that has been occurring, and I understand has been working reasonably well, but there's no intention through the proposed district plan to incorporate those processes and work, and we aren't addressing that process. I do appreciate that submissions have raised it, and but it sits outside the plan, and there isn't any intention for it to become part of the plan or to be essentially replaced by this. That process may well use the new guidelines, I would hope. But we haven't addressed it, and as far as my instructions are, it isn't addressed through the proposed plan for variation one.
So in terms of the Arrowtown residential zones, there is no obligation on any applicant to go through that non-statutory process. Is that correct?
That's correct in terms of what's been notified.
And the business, I'm not sure about the town centre zones, I have not that many detail yet, but the business zones throughout the district tend to have an urban design panel approach, and I can understand that when the business zones you can deal with that.
Yes, I believe it's still discretionary, not mandatory, but practices.
We'll give you the chance to tell us about that.
When I thought it was appropriate, basically.
Would we intend?
I had a better question for somebody here.
So, in terms of practice, my understanding is that in terms of the old residential part of Arrowtown, that any new development that falls within that under the current law framework is referred to the Arrowtown Planning Advisory Group.
Right.
As well as the main town centre area, and I'm not aware that that practice is going to change as a consequence of this.
So, where in the plan is any user advised of that?
I'm not aware that there's actually any reference. Certainly the guidelines don't reference to to that group.
So there's no statutory requirement, so if someone chooses not to, the council could still go ahead and process the application and grant consent irrespective of the views or thoughts of the Arrowtown Planning, is that correct?
Well, I think in practice, the way that the council administers its resource consents in that part of the district, that they are referred to the Arrowtown Advisory Planning Group.
Under what authority? There must be something in the plan that gives them the authority to do that.
Yes. I'm not sure that there's any specific reference under the operative plan as it stands at the moment. It may actually be just adopted practice that the council's undertaken over the years.
There's a whole lot of adopted practices that didn't have a statutory basis. I know, but I'm just wondering, an applicant's entitled to make an application in accordance with the provisions of the plan and the requirements of the Act. They can't be required to do something outside of that, can they?
I think they need a high level of transparency around what the rules of the district plan are actually directing them to achieve. So, if the guidelines are reflecting what positive development outcomes should be adopted, you would think that general public should be have sufficient certainty in the guidelines that if they achieve that, that the council is going to at least approve the development.
That doesn't answer the question as to on what authority. Can you refer to something in section 104, perhaps, that would suggest that the council could refer an application to a non-statutory body and then take advice from it? Which essentially seems to be what's happening.
Yes, I think that's strange. Recommend you refer back, that's all right.
When you're doing that, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
How I've interpreted this issue was that the council might be relying on the provisions of section 42A in terms of the commissioning of reports or an application. And in addition to or instead of anything in the plan, that might be part of your consideration to report back to us.
Yes, thank you. What I suggest is we speak more to the council to get a better understanding, but share my understanding that at present there's nothing in the operative plan and it's a matter of practice.
Yes, whereas when in the proposed plan, where it's proposed that the other design panel consider things, it is actually explicitly written in business terms that that's the case.
Yes.
And I think it seems to me that the proposed plan was not written and not predicated on that basis in Arrowtown residential areas.
Yes, I think in terms of the Queenstown Town Centre Zone, there is reference to an urban design and a town reference. So.
And there isn't the one as well. Any
questions?
Thank you. So we will turn to Ms. McDonald, who is the council's first
So I've been engaged by QOVC to provide evidence in relation to the RSA Design Guides 2016. I initially became involved with the project in February 2015, when I assisted the council with the identification of appropriate boundaries for the proposed medium density residential zone in RSA specifically. Since September 2015, I've been assisting with the revision and update of the RSA Design Guidelines. In my evidence are just three matters. Firstly, the workability of the old New Town chapter in the 2016 guidelines. Secondly, the Arrowtown Historic Management Transition Overlay that's proposed in response to submissions on the NDRSF, with the matter of discussion being consistency of Arrowtown's character and utilising the 2016 guidelines as a guide. And thirdly, the different approach from the low density residential zones is submission seeking this development to be sympathetic to its surroundings. In relation to the workability of the old and new town chapter of the 2016 guidelines, the creation of a combined chapter compared with the out-of-town design guidelines of 2006 is in part a response to my own concerns regarding, firstly, the accessibility and complexity of the 2006 guidelines, and secondly, the inability to incorporate additional guidelines for the NDRZ, which is the direct boundary of the out-of-town residential heritage management zone, into the 2006 guidelines. The intention of the change has been to create a logical, easy-to-follow document that enables designers to bring forward developments which are sympathetic to the character of our town. Whilst I recognise Mr. Blakely's and that submission 28 concerns, I believe the 2016 guidelines have more than overcome the shortcomings of the 2006 guidelines for the following reasons. Firstly, the overall document is over 20% shorter. The structure is now more readily accessible and understandable. There's less duplication. Combining the old town and new town sections of the 2006 guidelines has allowed the required amendments for the proposed MDRZ to be simply integrated into the 2016 guidelines and read within the context of the requirements of other zones. And lastly, the use of colour to highlight different provisions which area they relate to allows users of the 2016 guidelines to easily identify relevant requirements. I believe the 2016 guidelines represent a logical, easy to follow document which ensures that users gain a wider understanding of design and layout matters relevant to the whole of our town. They are then able to use this understanding to inform the design of their own scheme in accordance with the 2016 guidelines. And just to sort of elaborate on that point a little bit, I think when I first began to look at the 2006 guidelines, I found it was very easy to sort of dive into the part that you thought was relevant to your scheme and perhaps ignore the wider context. And I think in where we brought the old and new town chapters together, you do have to read it as a whole, or you're more inclined to read it as a whole, which gives you a better understanding of the wider issue, and perhaps because it's also a shorter document overall and a bit more clear, I think, in terms of the way it's laid out, you are more likely to look at the whole document as well than you would have been previously. Returning to my paragraph 8, the proposed alterations to section 4.8 of the guidelines, as set out in the evidence and this advice, clarifies its intention to only encourage some of the characteristics of the old town cottage style within the NDRZ and LDRZ rather than to replicate its style throughout the area. In relation to the transition overlay, given the potential for a development for the NDRZ to have a negative impact upon the settlement of the ARHNZ, I consider it beneficial for all developments within that part of the NDRZ closest to the boundary with the heritage zone to be considered against the 2016 guidelines. I therefore support the approach outlined in section 42A hearing report for chapter 8 medium density residential developments to include the transition overlay. And the potential for development within the LDRZ to have a negative impact on the setting of the heritage management zone below, I don't believe it's necessary to introduce a transition overlay area within the LDRZ in our town. I therefore support the approach outlined in the section 42A hearing report for chapter 7, low density residential developments, to not have a transition overlay. Thank you.
I do have a few questions. Not a few evidence, it's mostly just about the guidance content. And it may well be that some of the questions I ask are better addressed by Mr. Bright. It's just feel welcome to pass that down the chain as appropriate. So could we start at 1.4 of the guideline document, which is on page 6.
Thank you.
And I'm interested in the third paragraph of 1.4, starting on the second sentence, which talks about more stringent application of the guideline the closer you are to the older portion of town. I guess my question is, how does that get administered? Particularly from the point of view of a council planner trying to assess consistency with the guideline,
yep.
They take the view that it's not consistent with the guideline, but then the guideline itself seems to say if there's some magic unspecified distance from the old town, maybe it doesn't matter anyway.
I think it's about that that's really done by the colour coding and the zoning that's in place, and therefore the relevant parts of the guideline which are highlighted for that particular zone. So I think one of the issues with it, sort of stepping back and thinking this is the evolution of the 2006 guidelines. The 2006 guidelines sort of spoke less of zones and more of sort of identified character and those sort of issues. And I think the way the guidelines have been amended, it does make much more specific reference to the zones. And
so
in a way, that paragraph could have almost been reworded, because effectively the zones and the colour coding that outlined below is doing what that paragraph is suggesting.
Okay, well that's a very helpful answer, because as I read it, I read it not thinking that at all. I read it thinking it was a note to people using it that it wasn't just a one size fits all.
I think it's probably that's more now rather than saying the guidelines do this through the through.
Okay.
Okay,
thank you. 1.5.2 on the same page at the bottom.
Yeah.
I guess this goes to the heart of one of a whole subset of questions. This issue of, and it's said throughout the guidelines, of not trying to do the replica toy town, of being authentic.
Mm.
But what is it with being authentic too? Because we talk about 1.5.2 about it being a remote mining town. But it's not a remote mining town anymore, is it? It's almost becoming a dormitory suburb of Queenstown.
Yeah.
And at what point are we sort of trying to be authentic to a character that's not authentic? And I'm talking now not so much about the heritage value of the old town section, I'm talking now about the new town components.
Yeah. I think in a way that's the issue that I picked up in the summary as well, and that we had this comment come through in submissions regarding whether it was appropriate to use the cottage lot for the whole of our town, for instance. And I think, again, that statement is something which is interpreted by the guidelines themselves, and therefore as you move from the town centre through the heritage zone, through medium density to the low density, you are gradually almost walking down how strongly you use the out-of-town character, as it were. So I think some of these statements perhaps are almost misleading in a way, in that it sounds like that's a statement that applies to the whole of out-of-town, and it's not. You are
you're actually diluting the character, as it were, by taking the GPU out because of what the guy might say.
Okay, well, thanks for that, sir. My understanding from the material is that one of the justifications for, I don't want to say the 2016 update of the previous guidelines, but the revision of the guidelines, was the inclusion of the Newtown areas in whatever graduated way is appropriate.
The Newtown areas were always included, and what struck me when I looked at the guide, as I said, I looked at the guide a long time ago, long before becoming involved in the project, and thought it was a great piece of work. There's a huge amount of information in there, but there was almost so much information that it was impenetrable. It was difficult to know where to start with it. And so that was my first concern when I was asked to become involved in this project, is how we make it something which is more accessible, more accessible and therefore encourage people to use it, let alone require them to use it for the district plan. So that was a concern in the back of my head, and then you would have seen from the information attached in the appendix to my evidence, I was thinking, well, we've got this green identity zone coming in, how do we incorporate that? Because it seems to me that the guidance in the 2006 version was obviously allowing greater scope of variation, as it were, from the Arrowden character within the low density zone than within the older parts of town. But it seems to me that we actually, for the medium density area to be successful, there needed to be more of the older town character coming through to ensure that it didn't sort of stick out like a sore thumb. So it's a case of how do you configure the guidelines to ensure that some of that becomes applicable to the medium density area. And actually, having gone through it, you'll see that in terms of actual new guidelines and information, there's not an awful lot in there regarding the medium density. We've just been some rewords of other things to make sure it's clear they apply. So it was really how to fit that medium density in successfully and recognise there's an awful lot of information in there that could be relevant to it. And then that led to the change of combining that chapter such that we have two chapters come together and then just colour-coded throughout that to show what was done into which. If that makes sense, that was my sort of thought process, was how to
update it. That wasn't really what I was asking for the first
meeting. Yeah, sorry.
But that's okay. Maybe it's my ignorance for not asking a sufficiently clear question. I'll jump to the end of where I was going to go here. The guideline is a huge document and it's got a lot of effort and thought gone into it. No question there, and that's not a criticism anyway. What I'm not understanding is if the majority of what I see is the development in that Newtown area is detached housing on single sites.
Mm.
And with the exception of the Ms. Leaf's proposed transition zone and the medium density zone, it's intended to be a completely permitted activity in the medium density zone and low density zone to do a house on a site without any reference to this work at all.
Yeah.
I'm sort of wondering what's the point of what's the point of making it apply to those zones, and in most instances it's not actually going to apply anyway.
Mm.
I mean, even a controlled activity status could have given landowners some certainty of approval on development rights, but got the guideline on the table. I don't quite understand that decision.
Yeah. I hear what you say, and I think much of the old town, the low density zone, particularly as you move further out, doesn't reflect the old town character as much as I would hope, I guess, would be my response. And I can see the benefit of, as you say, a controlled activity zone, where that could be something that someone wished to pursue. I guess that sort of therefore returns, and that in the back of my mind, is the fact that I found the old guidelines very inaccessible, and at least I hope that if although still large, these felt more accessible, we might encourage more people to read them and use them and take notes of them than we'd otherwise have, even though effectively you couldn't consistently hear.
Yep.
So that was sort of in the back of my mind.
Okay, thank you. On page 7, and don't worry, I don't have questions for every page.
No.
But just on page 7,
yeah.
The
The second paragraph to 1.5.5, it talks about those checklists. And the question is, should there be rules in the district plan itself that actually specify the level and type of additional information, if any, that applicants needing consent, including consideration of the guidelines, should provide? Because as I read that paragraph that says, yes, the checklist should be provided, my understanding is if I'm an applicant and I don't want to, I don't have to. Because while the guideline might require them, that's not the same as a rule in a plan. And that's how I see it. I might be wrong, but what's your sense of where the guideline talks about things like do landscape assessments and do the checklists? Is your expectation that people should actually have to do them?
I think, to be fair, it would be slightly more pragmatic about it. And it is a list of ideals, but depending on the location of the development, it may not be necessary to do all of those things, or may not be appropriate to do all of those things. Because it could be quite onerous to do everything, but there's certain things there that I think may need to be worked through in all of those cases. But I haven't given a great deal of thought to that.
But I think probably what's most important from my perspective is the the site analysis information.
Thank you. On page 8, one of the things that occurred to me just reading through the story of RSM at the very high level in the history, there is an argument, isn't there, that if I buy a piece of Newtown low density residential zone near or adjacent to an existing area of recent contemporary housing, but it doesn't reflect the really historical characteristics of our town. But isn't there an argument that if I bought that piece of land in the low density zone, I could say what's around me is part of the character of our town? We can't just ignore the bits that we don't think are fashionable. The character is the character of the settlement, and while some of it might not be what aesthetically pleases everyone, that is the character of the town I'm buying into. Why can't I be like that? And I guess where that's going to was when I went through the guideline, I didn't see much in the way of what are the unsuccessful bits of character that we should not do anymore. It's sort of swept under the rug that there's been some development that's not nice, and I wonder whether that's the correct way of acknowledging what is the character, what are the character values that are preferable, as opposed to just pretending they're the only ones. I'm not suggesting that, because that's what's happening, of course.
I mean, the difficulty is I'm not a great fan of design guides that show the things that are bad, because it's a bit of finger pointing, and I'm not sure that it leads as a positive guide, although I can understand there's a lot of learning to come from reviewing these things and thinking how successful they've been, and perhaps that should be something which would have been better sitting alongside the guide and be part of the review perhaps, rather than within it. But I just don't think, I'm just not a fan of the approach of saying, don't do this, if you see what I mean, and show them an example. I want to consider to be bad examples. But I hear what you say, and I think, in relation to bringing forward a development that's adjacent to something which perhaps doesn't reflect the Aratan characters as long as it could, yes, that has to be a factor that's got to be taken into account. But I don't think that's the reason that necessarily we should be really sort of legitimising that compromise within the document itself. I just feel uneasy with the concept of doing that.
Well, let me put a scenario to you. Again, you're in the role of a council planner. I'm an applicant. I say, I'm in that low-density edge of the Newtown kind of style. I say, I've taken on board the spirit of the guideline, I've done a site analysis, I've done a context analysis, I've done a landscape analysis, I've looked at everything around me, and everything around me happens to be 1980s style bland housing, and therefore I am entirely consistent with and responding to my context and character by doing the same thing. Is that not a legitimate way someone could argue they're doing all of the analysis the guideline talks about to actually justify the kind of development outcome that I think the guideline is actually suggesting happens but shouldn't happen again?
And if that is something that could happen, should that loophole be shut by the guidelines saying explicitly there are some outcomes in this era that weren't seen as ideal and in hindsight they shouldn't be used going forward? Notwithstanding all those comments you talked about not wanting to be negative in the guide, which I understand.
I mean, I think perhaps, yes, that single paragraph or sentence says something similar might be, or could be, for sure our advice. I mean, I think that the scenario you gave would probably be a legitimate response from a developer if we didn't have the guidelines. And I think the guidelines, as you've rightly pointed out, is trying to turn the corner from that. And therefore, perhaps the guidelines specifically need to say, yes, we recognise that and we are trying to turn that corner.
Well, I think
so. Yes,
okay. 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 Okay, I won't pursue that one. Fast forwarding to 3.2, which is on page 54, I think.
Yes.
So the first question is actually one to counsel that I neglected to ask earlier. So, the plan incorporates the guidelines by reference. The guidelines in turn make reference to other documents, in this instance the ICOMOS Charter. Does the plan therefore include the ICOMOS Charter by reference to its reference?
No.
So I could ignore that if I was using the guideline in terms of the restrictions of discretion.
What it does here is refer to the description of conservation practice in the charter, but it's not referring to the entire charter.
Well no, it says follow the principles of the ICOMOS New Zealand Charter. So does that mean the principles of the charter have been included by reference?
I'm sorry, I'm looking. Are you in
3212. This is the direction to follow a separate document.
Subsequent documents, and I don't believe Schedule 1 of the RMA goes that far.
I suspect A to H are the principles anyway.
Yes, I think they are.
But I'm just asking you a legal question.
I don't believe that's the extent of what Schedule 1 does do, but I will take a note of that.
Yes, thank you.
For you.
Well, perhaps also, Ms. Scott, could you check? I can't remember off the top of my head, but there is a long list of things incorporated into this proposal. I'm not sure whether the ICOMOS Charter is or not.
I don't recall it being one. No.
Just for reference, the ICOMOS Charter is referred to in the heritage section as well as some of the
that's why.
But glancing through those, it's been a few months since I looked at the ICOMOS Charter and I can never remember the principles off the top of my head, but I don't think those are the principles that are listed there.
Okay, all right. So thank you for that. So back to you, Mr. Noffin. So clause E. Heritage conservation is a specialist field and qualified experts should be used to provide guidance. And throughout the guidelines, there's reference to heritage architect, conservation architect, there's reference in a checklist to landscape architect. If I'm a well-meaning purchaser of a piece of land in Arrowtown, I want to do the right thing. Could cause E be sharpened to actually say which qualified experts? Because it feels like it's just the usual array of architect, landscape architect, urban designer, planner. And if that is the case, does it even necessary?
And I think we're in the same situation with heritage experts as we are with urban designers. He's a heritage expert and he's an urban designer as well. So I think we're saying yes.
Maybe the issue is the use of the words a specialist field. Maybe it's more about saying it's a complicated issue and experts trained in this can help, which might be a bit more open-ended than but actually suggesting it's an area of explicit expertise of its own. I'm not sure, but what I read, and I just, I wasn't sure who the authors of the guideline had in mind.
No, I think you're right. I think that's open to interpretation of his intent. And it's really finding the right person to
take the job. Okay, but the main event on this page for me was clause G. And the idea that new work should be of its own era while respecting the context. I mean, this seems to me to strike at the heart of the new development, new town, old town relationship. Do you think there's any internal contradiction or conflict between guidance saying if it's a 2016 house, it should reflect 2016 values, which might include the size of rooms, the size of house, and other explicit guidance that goes into the materials, the shape, the size of rooms, the configuration of rooms, the internal layout by definition of stacking smaller floors together, and so on. So, for instance, open plan living is part of contemporary era, which leads to larger, blander external forms to get a nice big internal shape.
I mean, I think the difficulty we've got is this actually just applies to transition as well.
Yes, in blue, yep.
And therefore, a limited number of parts of the development are going to become involved in that same centre. And if you then look at the development which has taken place since 2006, it would be questionable as to whether they've actually achieved what she says.
Yeah.
And stepping back and looking at this again, I think G is quite simplistic in terms of the way that it's written. And I think having something which is identifiable as era when it was built is an approach, but it's not always the correct approach or not only the only approach to making the appropriate approach.
Yeah, when I read this, I was reminded of an example where I was sitting on an urban design panel in Auckland in a precinct, and the plan talked about the rhythm and design of previous buildings, and the approach of that project's architect was, this is a town centre, the current era of retail thinking is floor to ceiling glass for the entire front facade. That's what it's all about, that's what today's taste is, and it juxtaposes with the old, and therefore it complements it, and therefore it's fantastic. And I wonder whether comments like G might seek to overall undermine what seems to be the otherwise consistent tone of the guideline, which is there's something special here about the heritage values and they're what's more important.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably too simplistic in its way.
Okay.
And accept what you make. And you know, the example you gave in some instances may be a valid approach, but in others it may not. And that's the issue, isn't it? The fact that it needs thought and assessment.
Okay. I'll leave these next ones for Mr. Bryce. No, I won't. I'll give you a tangent. Where the guide talks about, for instance, in 3.5, public open spaces, and 3.6, paving, drainage and curbs, which isn't limited to public roads but includes them. How important is it in your mind that those non-private spaces play their part in achieving the vision of the guideline for an overall character in Arrowtown?
I think it's very significant, and they're essential to the character, and if the streets were altered significantly, the whole character of Arrowtown would potentially just fall apart. So, by way of that example, yes, it is very important, but I think the difficulty is the guide sort of goes beyond the RMA, because there's clearly other departments of council responsible for those matters.
Well, that's my next question.
And my understanding is they do take note of what the 2006 guide says, and therefore take note of this. And you'll notice in the 2006 guide there's a complete chapter about talking about the area of Angola River, which has been taken out, because of course that's covered by, you know, reserve management plans and other departments in council, whatever, it was felt that it wasn't necessary to have it in here. So certainly the 2006 guide had lots of things that went well beyond the RMA. And this does have things which get on the RMA, but then the question would be, where else do you put them if it happened here?
Well, the statement that goes beyond the RMA is only true insofar as the council exempts itself from having to get resource consents.
Yeah.
It could require itself to get resource consent for any works within a public road within Arrowtown for the purpose of delivering the guidelines vision. Mm-hmm. It's just elected not to, and we might come to a recommendation that that's an unsound method in light of the significance you've told us.
Yeah.
Sits on that. So that's one side of them. Mm-hmm. But let's continue with the reliance on reserve acts, local government act, land transmission act. Would it be your expectation that the council would require those departments using those acts to effectively treat this guideline as if it had been prepared under those acts to deliver on its commitment to the guideline, for want of a better phrase?
I would hope that was the case. My understanding, I mean, Mr. Price may be in a better position to answer that in terms of discussions he's had with people in council, but my only discussions were that the council effective, the whole council uses it.
Right, or the 2006 guide. Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. If we came to, where would we sit? Now, this is not a question for you. I'll leave it to Mr. Price. Sorry, Mr. Bryce, I just realised I might be stressing you out.
I'm not a stressful person, it's fine.
Glad to hear it. Okay, so can we go to page 92, it's 4.1. So now we are into one of the residential zones by virtue of the colour of the box.
Yes.
So my understanding of how the guideline is structured is that there's a lot of explanatory rationale, there's a lot of setting out what the issues are, and the coloured boxes are the sharp end of the pencil. Mm-hmm. These are the things you have to do.
Yeah.
So in terms of the coloured box on page 92, that was one of the few coloured boxes that I struggled to understand as an applicant what it was I'm actually being asked to do, because it's more of a list of things that are important, and I wonder whether in fact it shouldn't have a colour-coded box on it.
Mm-hmm.
So your comment on, as an applicant, what it is you think 4.1.1 would actually require me to do would be helpful.
Over this, I think you picked up a point that really what this is doing is setting the scene for the guidance that comes after, later in that section, rather than perhaps being something which. So I guess it's debatable whether it should be covered or not.
Well, let's pick that up in terms of a question I asked earlier and keep your thoughts on it. So again, let's say, again, you're the council planner. You've got to turn your mind to the guideline and see whether are you really only interested in the coloured boxes, or would you be looking at the entire guideline whether it's coloured or not?
My hope is that people will look at the whole guidelines, and as I said, one of the issues I found in 2006 was almost so large and slightly complex in its structure that you did dive into parts of it. I think with this. Hopefully there's more encouragement for people to actually understand the whole of the colour class before working their way through the coloured boxes.
Do you think in that respect having the coloured boxes might be unhelpful to achieve what you just described if it's actually structured as it currently is, to say the coloured boxes are the guidance?
Yeah, I haven't thought of it from that direction. I sort of thought that people would use the whole and then direct their attention to the coloured boxes rather than necessarily jumping straight to them.
I'm just trying to think of that consent planner that's under a crushing workload and has given a 180-page guideline.
I think the difficulty is, without the colour, it could remain a little difficult to navigate. I was possibly one of the, still one of the longest design guidelines I've ever come across.
Other than the 2006 version.
Well, other than the 2006 version.
Yeah. What's a longer one?
I'm not sure what I'm actually now.
Well, probably the Urban Design Compendium or something like that, which is something very different in terms of its status.
With the coloured boxes, is the reality that you're an applicant or a consent panel dealing with something in one particular zone, the coloured boxes relating to the other zones become irrelevant and everything else is relevant? Is that really what you're trying to say?
See, my hope is that anyone using the guide will look to understand the guide as a whole, because that will enable them to, if you're looking at the information requirements, for instance, to the bank, and you're looking at the, some of the assessments they're encouraged to do under their own terms of understanding the guide analysis and describing their proposal and working away through their proposal, all of that will become so much easier if they understand this as a whole and they've gone through this as a whole. Because it's almost as if this has given them the answers to those questions. And I don't think that whatever guidance document you put together, you can't stop people just diving into the piece they can swim in. And we're all guilty of that at one time or another, just diving into the bit and answering that question and moving on. So the intention was just to make this as easily accessible as a whole as possible. But, yes, and I understand your point in that when you're reading it, you'll just ignore the other colours. Hopefully you read all the working hands of a colour behind it, and you read the other colour for you.
Well, if you're in the low density residential zone, how relevant is the coloured boxes for the Yarrowtown
Yarrowtown zone? I mean, if you were, I think probably, if, you know, my hope, I guess, if you're working on the town centre, you read as far as all of the, up to and including all of the town centre information, and if you're working within the, for instance, the low density zone, you read everything up to and including that, because that then sets the context for what you're doing. So the further out you are, the more you have to read. But I mean, the difficulty is, of course, is that we can't, be sure that happens.
Well, I'd like to test that, because my next question on page 96 is very closely related to what you've just been asked, which is at 4.1.2.2a. And this is a comment that's made in a number of instances in the guideline that talks about historic character can't compromise or be compromised by developments in adjacent areas. Doesn't that effectively require people using the guidelines to read the whole guideline so they can show how they're not compromising adjacent areas?
Yeah, which is, in a way, what the end result would be that I described.
Yeah.
If you're designing in the low density zone, you're going to have to use the whole
So I think it's a bit stronger.
You may not have to use the whole lot.
No, I think your answer to the chair, as I heard it, was more you'd hope it would be used in a holistic way, but it seems to me that it's actually directing people to do it.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
So it is requiring that, isn't it?
On page 103 at 4.5.1.3b, just a simple one.
So 4.5.1.3b.
B, yeah. So the 60% of the street frontage. I just wanted to understand, is that 60% of the frontage width of a site, or is there a particular depth of back within a site that's 60% of a certain surface area? Could we calculate? I'm just trying to figure out what the 60% is.
Yes, I don't think it's defined.
But I've seen some plans that talk about a proportion of the frontage elevation, and I've seen others that talk about the width of the site multiplied by the front yard setback equals a certain area, and then a proportion of that has to be landscaped. So I'm just trying to figure out which, or something else.
Yeah.
You had in mind.
thinking about the 60% of the area of the width between the building up to the depth. I mean, there's width and depth, isn't there?
Yeah.
That must be 60% of the width. But the question therefore remains, how deep is the site? And I think in the low density zone, my thinking was as far as the building, i.e. within the setback.
Okay, so basically it's width and depth in your view.
Yeah.
However.
Yeah, whatever the setback.
Thank you.
The setback is in that particular instance.
Yeah, thank you. Then if we go, to 126 at 4.10.1.3. This is one of those instances where I think the guidelines seem to be crossing over between what an applicant should be required to do and what the council, if it's also following the guides, might do. And I'm interested in A, an overall landscape plan for the streets. It seems like a lot of work for me to do just to put a house on my section between 300 and 449 square metres.
Mm.
And it leads me to wondering whether or not there's a need in the guides to have a more explicit differentiation of what applies to a landowner and what should apply to a public authority, given that the guide itself says it's public and private.
Yeah.
And then this is, again, this is about helping applicants, it's about helping neighbours understand what their neighbours might have to do, it's about helping that poor consent planner who's wondering and angsting at night whether to send a Section 92 request mm-hmm. for a landscape plan for the whole town.
Mm-hmm. I guess, I mean, this really applies, for instance, A in particular, something like that applies in two instances. One, obviously, to existing streets that the council is managing, and secondly, to new streets created by a large subdivision.
Is there any potential for large subdivision in that area?
Probably not a lot. So on that basis, this is really, you know, the main implications of this council.
The plant lists, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate.
Yeah.
Have I read the guideline correctly to the extent that all these lists are doing is saying the species are compatible, but that matters to do with their distribution and planting on site would still be a matter of considering what the guideline trying to achieve and possibly the council disagreeing and what have you, or is the view, I've got approved trees, I've put them where I want.
I mean, I think there's further guidance forward in the document in relation to hedges and trees and their importance within, you know, about, in terms of creating and maintaining character. So I think these sort of approved lists as we've seen in that context, there's sort of supplementary information to assist, I guess, in a way, as to what works and what's appropriate when you're interpreting guidance further forward.
Well, what I want to understand is if I'm an applicant
yep.
and I use trees that are approved,
yes.
does that mean the council's only, if anything, going to have a debate with me about where I plant them? It's not going to come back and say, even though those are approved, we prefer to use different ones. Like, am I, if I, as a user, if it's got a tick saying it's okay, does that mean whether the council likes that particular tree or not in that site, that's the end of it? Or do you think, given as you prefer to, that other guidance talking about landscaping and character, that the council could still revisit the question of how the species are being used?
Now, my understanding is because this is specific to each of the areas, and there's a tick all across each area, that providing you've got a tick in the relevant box, that debate's gone. It is about layout and the position that's going to be an issue.
Well, I'm winding up my questions, you'll be pleased to know.
written a lot of guidelines, as you say, you've clearly used a lot of guidelines in different contexts, and you'll be familiar with assessment criteria and other plans which are the same as guidelines, they may just not be as illustrated. Have you found that there's a relationship between the quantity of individual criterions someone has to look at and the extent to which a consent authority might refuse consent on the basis of not complying with only one or a very small number of those criterions, as opposed to there's 1,000 criteria and I think I can get 600 of them, therefore on balance I'm doing okay, it becomes a numbers game. Have you had any experience with that kind of phenomenon, or do you see it happen?
Yeah, I mean, I understand where you're coming from, and I think, yes, it is a concern that you may be missing 99 and there's one that's not met, and therefore that's a cost, and therefore that means you don't get consent. I think perhaps it's so it's interpretation and use that's important. So I guess really the question is, or is your question really, does this make it clear enough that we're not expecting a score 100%?
Well, I don't know what the implication is. That's the first part. There's a number of questions. One is
I don't think anyone's expecting a score 100%.
The other question is, are there any criteria that you expect to be typically so much more important than others that they should be highlighted to prevent people effectively just picking the ones that are easy to do? Say, on balance, I meet more than 75% or 80%. I mean, so many of them, I must be in overall accordance, but actually failing the fundamental ones. Because at the moment, the guidance doesn't really consistently say A, B, and C typically are much more important than X, Y, Z. I'm not suggesting the guidance should say that. I'm not even sure if the intent is there. I'm just trying to test with you, given how much material there is, do you see a risk that people can just pick the ones that suit them and say, in almost any instance, how can you say I'm not meeting the guidance? Here's 50 ones I've met.
I think I haven't gone through the guidelines to identify which elements I consider to be more important than others and which are fundamentals and which aren't. But I'm sure whoever I think the guidelines would be able to.
Well, so maybe there isn't such a differentiation. Mm.
I think there probably is going to be some which are have-to-haves and some which are good-to-haves.
Well, I certainly think if you had a view that some were, even if it's a case that there might be exceptions, but if you felt that in general there are some that will be much more important than others, that it might be helpful for us to know.
But I think it might be, it may sort of go back to, you know, when I started looking at 2006 guidelines, I found them almost impenetrable and just saved the information there. And I think we've got to a position where we've got something which I feel is far more accessible. But it still may be worth, I think, given your question, it's made me think, is whether it's worth getting through and highlighting a few things which perhaps those who are most
important. Okay, last question. And it's just how you understand or how you see the checklists at the back working. Would you expect someone applying for resource consent would include the checklists as part of their application, or do you see this as something that applicants themselves work through as they move through the guidance?
Yeah, I mean, I see it more as something for the design committees as they go through, because there is so much information here, it is actually an opportunity to ensure that they haven't missed anything basically on the way through.
I've just added a question, even though I said last question. This is my last question.
Yeah, I'm happy with that.
My last question. If we came to a view, and no one in the room should get nervous that this is the case, but if we got to the view where we had sufficient questions about
whether or not the guideline is really in its final state, and some of your answers have suggested maybe there is some room for improvement. If we got to the view that said we thought the guide was a great idea, wasn't quite there yet, and that if it was kept outside of the plan, among other things, it would allow the council to make whatever updates it wanted, when it wanted, without being caught by a plan change process. Do you think that the guide would still have sufficient ability to make a difference, or do you think it really has to be part of the plan? So this is now a question about, can we rely on it if it's not inside the plan?
So my understanding is the 2006 guidelines was never in the plan. There has still been positive outcomes as a result of the 2006 guidelines, and therefore you know, you can't dismiss it because it was outside the plan. All of this was outside the plan, you can dismiss it. It would certainly still have a positive impact. But I think, in a way, we're moving to a new era, almost, because we've got this median density residential zone coming forward. And I think that's actually bringing forward issues which haven't been issues in the past, because where you have the low density adjacent to the heritage management area, there was always the ability of that to impact upon the character and of the heritage management area was always less than the potential for the region density to impact. And therefore, I think for that reason, it's becoming really important to give it a greater statutory weight and to bring it into the plan. So I would feel happier as we move forward that it comes into the plan.
Okay. Thanks for that. And now, my last question. Can I ask you just to look at proposed policy 8.2.2.6 in the medium density zone, that can just be looked up and given to you? Now, this is now saying development take into account any adopted design guide or urban design strategy applicable to the area.
Yeah.
So if, as we've been told in other hearings, the council independently proposed a separate design guideline for the medium density housing zone that might say a whole bunch of different things to the Arrowtown specific guides, would you anticipate that such future guides would apply or even be necessary, or would it be better, if possible, for that policy to actually exclude the Arrowtown medium density zone, given that it's got its own guide already that's very location and place specific?
Well, I think in terms of policies themselves, recognise that Arrowtown is a different example to the others, because there's a different height limit, for instance, amongst other things within the medium density zone. So Arrowtown is certainly seen as a special case in terms of policy, and therefore, yeah, I would be concerned that if we had two guidelines in place, that there could be confusion and perhaps have a lesser an outcome which is less appropriate to Arrowtown occurring than would be the case if we just relied upon this one. So, yes, I think it might be appropriate to exclude Arrowtown from any general guidelines.
All right. Thank you for all those answers.
Thank you.
Questions. We'll adjourn from